The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
So welcome everyone. My name is Davies Owens. I'm at the Ambrose School out in Boise, Idaho. I'm the head of vision and advancement out there, but I'm in Atlanta, and so I feel really at home here. So it's good to be back. I was at Heritage Preparatory School for about 10 years, board guy, and then eventually head of school there. And in my earlier days of working in local church ministry and even all the way back to majoring in sociology, I've always been interested in the issues around the church and the culture, or the school and the culture, and why we miss and why we don't connect. And part of my job at Ambrose is trying to figure out how do we do a better job of reaching out to new families, everything from admissions to retention of our families to helping them assimilate in. We continue to do something very distinctive from the culture outside our doors. So the talk today is really just sort of my own musings and trying to figure this thing out. The world is moving at a very quick pace outside our doors. The millennials are coming. They are here. Some of them are us. And I want to talk a little bit about kind of why that's important, and hopefully give you some practical suggestions of what to do with all of that. So, and at the end of all this is a presentation. I'll give you a link on your smartphone. You can actually pull this thing down, and we'll do that at the end. So don't feel like you've got to take – you have notes, and it'll follow the notes to some extent. But I do want to talk a little bit about kind of this generation that's coming out of schools called the millennials. These are folks that not only take selfies of their kids, but they're different from the generations before. So let me just begin by kind of walking you through kind of this walk of the 20th century and what's happened generationally. There are probably there are experts out there who will tell you that all of this hubbub about generational differences is really overblown. At the end of the day, we're all humans, and they're right at a base level. But as you and I probably detect, there are big differences that happen from one generation to the next, and there are deep biases that are part of our schools and part of our churches that we'll look at. So let's just kind of back up to what's often known as the builder generation. These are folks born kind of 1901 to 45. They're kind of the 71 crowd. This is my grandparents. Grandfather fought in World War II. Greatest generation, the silent generation. They were the do-without generation. Maybe you remember grandparents like this. They recycled all kinds of crazy things before that was the vogue thing to do. Delayed gratification, absolutely. We don't need it now. We'll wait on it. Defined by job. My wife's grandfather worked for the Hercules Corporation up in Delaware for 40 years, and he actually got a watch at the end. I mean, it was loyalty and commitment straight through. That's the builder generation. And then, and by the way, I'll just ask any builders in here. Anybody can say I'm a builder generation? Well, there are not many of them. That's they're not here today. They're 71 overcrowded. Then we kind of got into the 52 to 70 year olds today. And again, if you're somebody going, I am 52 and I am not a part of that. Okay, I'm not. I'm really a millennial. It's okay. This is not forced. But again, it's these trends, and that's kind of the boomer. Or we have come the hippie generation, 46 to 64. When they were born, age 52, 70 now, they were influenced by the forces around them. Vietnam was a big part of that. Woodstock was part of that. So here's a generation that watched, lunar landing on the moon, pretty amazing feat of humanity. And then in the same sort of moment, Watergate's going on. So there's this sort of immediate sense of we can do anything, but we're highly suspicious. And we're anti-establishment. Identity was really about work. I'm a banker. I'm an attorney. That's what I am. It's who I am. And prosperity was kind of part of that. I want to be successful. Moving very quickly through these, Gen X, I'm feeling at home here, 65 to 78, that was the age of, the Challenger explosion. Most of you probably remember when that happened and where you were. That was when video games, I still had the Atari, some of you can talk about that later. MTV, remember when all that was happening. Autonomy was sort of part of that generation. 80s material world, material girl thing was going on. Work and life balance. It's like, yeah, I want to work, but I want to have some fun on the side too. And really some disillusionment. And it's just a sense in which the world's really broken. And I'm not sure about that. And again, I could do a whole talk on any one of these. Again, there's still room up here on the front and a couple front seats. I see people on the back for a couple side seats. Age 38 to 51. Any Gen Xers in here? Probably most of us are Gen Xers. Yeah. Jumped over. We should back up. Any kind of baby boomers in here? Heavy generation? Good. All right. I shouldn't call you hippie. That doesn't work. All right. Gen X. Moving on. And then we're going to talk today about millennials. So kind of getting you where they are in the flow. This is kind of the 78 to 96. Again, you can research it. There's going to be a five-year shift on either side of it. People trying to figure out exactly when it happened and when it didn't. Oh, lights are on. Can we cut them back off? Some people were sleeping, and I didn't. Sorry about that. Millennials are kind of the 21 to 38 year olds. They were influenced by kind of 9/11 terrorism, formative moment in their life. Columbine. One article I read. What, can we get the lights back off? Do we know how they came on? Elise, can you find that out? Okay. Elise will figure that out. You know, when you think about like the Kennedy shooting or the King shooting, those were very singular moments in history. Columbine really changed the definition. All of a sudden, it was a community that was being impacted in a significant way. Technology integration. Again, we'll talk a lot more about millennials, just kind of giving you a high level. They grew up with a smartphone almost in their hand. Constant feedback. Very team-oriented, very socially responsible. Diversity is a big part of it. They are the largest demographic group and will only continue to be so. Again, we'll look at that in a minute, at 78 million people. And just so you have a kind of frame of where this is going, kind of what's after millennials, or call them Gen Zs, they're here. And they're old. My daughter would be one. Oldest just turned 19. She's about to turn 18, born 97, and after coming of age under the Obama presidency. I won't even talk about what that might mean. Corporate bailouts. And the story's really being written. We're not ready to give that talk just yet. But I just wanted to, you know, if you kind of frame this up, so we kind of figure out where we are in the room, here's the question for you. If you had to think about classical Christian education, just knee-jerk reaction, if you had to just get in your time machine and go to the optimal time when you think classical Christian education would just be really effective, where would you drop the time machine? Back in the builders, the boomers, the Gen Xers? What do you think? Who would just be like, oh, I love this. This is great. Builders, absolutely. And how many builders were in the room? And maybe some boomers, but builders, I think, would be, yeah, all of those great things. Which, quick footnote, doing fundraising, builders love this because they're like, finally, somebody's doing something that I remember. Like, yeah, it's classical Christian education. It's good stuff. Problem is, they're not coming to school these days that much. Grandparents' Day, but that's about it. And I would say, so why pay attention? Why am I doing this? Why does this matter so much? They are the future. Millennials are the future. U.S. Census, again, just emphasizing this. World population, I know it's so hard to see on that kind of greenish screen, but the millennials are here. You can kind of see here. You look at, by the time you get to 2030, they are affecting everything. They're our parents, they're running organizations, they are the largest population that is coming. They are here. So it's not a matter of do we want to think about it. It will happen, and it is happening all around us. It impacts everything in the life of the school. And again, as I think about what the many things we do, and I'll get into this in just a moment, but so many things in the life of our school, I think, really have generational impacts. That we're just, if that filter set's not there, if you do nothing else when you walk out there, they go, and not that, oh, you're one of those and I'm one of these, but just a sensitivity to the world is a little bit different. Communications, volunteer recruitment, donations, staff dynamics, mission and effectiveness. And I got to tell you, as I started doing this research, I don't think schools have quite figured out that we need to be having these conversations. The corporate world is deeply thinking about this. I had a unique opportunity on Wednesday morning, friends with folks in the Chick-fil-A world based here in Atlanta. Our school ate a lot of chicken. Look at Jason and Nathan. Like, we ate a lot of Chick-fil-A chicken around our school. And I remember about 5 years ago, one of the VPs at Chick-fil-A said, yeah, we've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to teach owner-operators how to work with new recruits who come in, the millennials coming in, that are deciding that that peach milkshake thing you make, there's just not enough peach sauce in it, so we're going to swirl a little bit differently. And they're going, no. We designed that a certain way, and even though you think you can make it what you want, you really need to follow it, so we got to train you differently. And then just Wednesday, I was at a fascinating, I was really honored to be there. It was like 50 of Chick-fil-A's executive team and creative folks, along with a team they brought in from California, an agency, and they're just basically asking, what is this business going to look like into the future? They're calling it the basically life outside of the store, beyond the store. And they were talking about things that are just unbelievable, like the on-demand industry, which I didn't know much about, but $2 billion industry by 2021. How many of you use Amazon Prime? And how many of you think it's too slow? Not 2 years ago, even three, you know, you've like, who needs it in 2 days? Like, that is just so unnecessary. Now it's like, I need like 2 hours. Like, bring the drone. Like, come on. So we're changing. The world's changing. Our parents are changing. Chick-fil-A is saying, look, we've got a 40% growth in just 1 year on the on-demand. On-demand is the college student with the app that says, I don't want to go down to the wherever and get the chicken sandwich. I want somebody to bring it to me. Or the corporate folks who say, I need the meal delivered. 276 Uber Eats type organizations are out there right now. And you probably have someone on your phone. You can pull an app. We'd be fun to see how much food we get in here in 15 minutes. But it's where things are changing. The customer expectation is shifting. And again, I don't want to minimize that we're doing kingdom work, but I want you to hear that we are a business. We are interacting with people, and we've got to think in these terms along the way. So it's helpful to us to just look at what's happening in Chick-fil-A. I'll mention one book that I found to be very helpful, Managing the Millennials, Discovering the Core Competencies for Managing Today's Workforce by Espinoza and some others, Managing the Millennials. There are tons of books. Corporate America is writing these books. They're thinking about how do we manage the millennials. And there's a lot of just transferable, you know, if you're head of school and you've got teachers and they're millennials, you've got to manage them differently than you did the boomers or the others that are in your school. We'll talk more about that. So millennials are interesting. Millennials really dismiss and embrace the upbringing. Sometimes millennials are called echo boomers, which is an interesting term because, again, we don't fall far from the tree in which we were planted, or the tree that grew us, however you want to use the analogy. So you take millennials today, and they grew up in a world of kind of the last key, maybe overscheduled, you know, boomer Gen Xer parent who had them scheduled, you know, the private soccer coach at, you know, third grade and drove them to everything. And they don't know life outside of being scheduled. So you have these millennial parents that are coming. And they have sort of the reverse of that. Like, we're not going to do that to our kids. We really want to be able to have choice, and we want our kids to kind of make decisions. We're going to reject 80s materialism. Like, we don't want that. In fact, look around Atlanta. You got all these 900-square-foot urban lofts. Like, we want, not only do we not want a carbon footprint, we don't want a car. We're going to live right here, and we're going to have minimalism. We're going to keep it really, really simple. So, in that, again, we'll talk about that. And there's so many kind of examples of, like, generations are the way they are because of the upbringing they had, and usually it's sort of a reaction that's swinging the other way. But there's also this interesting embracing of things in which they were brought up in. We've moved really from the 80s kind of individualism, me generation indulgence to sort of an idolatry really of children today, many by millennials who see kids in this very, it is a primary responsibility. Part of it is because kids do not grow up well with parents, and then they feel like they need to, or they didn't grow up with the attention that they wanted. And so they're really going to even push in more. Working on lights. So kind of from helicopter parents to what some are calling snowplow parents. I mean, like, we're moving. And maybe you've got some of these that have already showed up at your school. So we moved from, like, helicopter would have been nice if you even touched the ground. You're, like, on the ground pushing things around, like snowplow. Time Magazine did an interesting article just last year, covers the me generation. So we went from the me generation to the me generation. And this great, interesting quote of a millennial mom, Romero, now a stay-at-home mom to four kids, is taking a much more relaxed and responsive approach to raising her own children. Quote, I wanted to be more of their friend than their mom and give them room to express themselves and be little people, she says. I never felt like I got that opportunity, again referencing the prior generation. Instead of hyper-directing their kids, many researchers believe there's a focus among today's millennial parents on a democratic approach to family management, constantly canvassing their children for opinions. So I don't know about you, but we're seeing this more and more at our school. We're seeing more and more, you don't like middle school? They're not all your friend? Well, where do you want to go to school? Well, you want to go down the street? They don't make you do Latin. That's great. Let's go there. It's like we have just outsourced the decision making. And again, it's very much part of that generation. Interesting little piece here. So Oberlin College, maybe you saw this in the news. Actually, here's the piece. That's great. Helicopter parents. So this is June 10th in the news. Oberlin College in Ohio. More than 1,300 students in Oberlin College have signed a petition asking administrators to abolish midterms in all grades below C to accommodate their busy protest schedules. The students say that attending demonstrations against social injustice leaves them little time to study. Quote, a lot of us started suffering academically, one student said. I mean, this is in the news. It's happening today. 1,300 students. Why? Because the virtue Protest used to be the anti-establishment of the 60s. It's now become a virtue. Like, it's virtuous to protest things. So we're going to, and again, this is reality. These are, so we're dealing with a very different wiring that's out there. So what does that mean for us? Well, on the one hand, I would say, I think it means we have to rethink some of our growth. And what I'm getting at there is just how, I was just talking to another one of our heads of schools here in Atlanta. He just said, you know, essentially, because we've got, according to kind of our ISM information, we've got a healthy board, we've got good parent-teacher relationships, teachers being trained well. Why aren't we growing? And part of it, I think, is that we are increasingly selling a product, back to my question before about this is really kind of a builder's product and a millennial generation. So the Pew Research Center, again, encourage you to go research, go look at what Pew's doing out there. They're constantly kind of calibrating what people are thinking. They have, they and Barna have come up with similar statistics that have said basically at a very precipitous rate, the traditional indicators of evangelical commitment, meaning belief in the inerrancy of Scripture, confidence in the physical resurrection of Jesus, those numbers are dropping faster than they've ever dropped. And so you see, for instance, with the Barna statistic, you know, since 2011, 48% believe the Bible is totally accurate in all of its principles it teaches. And in 2016, 5 years later, it's at 33%. So the bottom line is you've got a massive population that we are trying to reach that are saying, I don't know that I really need that level of unique education. I'm okay with just went to church on Sunday and we do the rest of the public school thing because they have better football or the whatever. And so even ACCS, talking to David Goodwin, changed their projections. Their board met and said, you know, we'd love to have 500,000 students by 2020 in classical Christian schools. We're not sure there's enough demand in the marketplace. Even if everybody does everything right internally, the marketplace, will it bear this many? And I think that's, there's a point at which I don't think we've ever set out to change the world, but it's sort of becoming more the Irish saving civilization. I think we've got to realize that we've got to manage our own expectations given the marketplace. How many people really want this product if we're not willing to compromise our product and hold true, which obviously we need to be. So I would just encourage you to think about that. You know, if you go down the road a bit to Lenox Mall or Phipps Plaza, where, you know, they have Teslas in the middle of the food court for you to choose, or high-end stores, you know, I guess it's like, I don't know about these things, maybe Coach Bags, let me walk in, there's like five purses on the wall, and they're like, you know, all with lots of zeros next to them. And that, if you were to have that environment and you set up the Amish quilt-making shop next to it and sold it, you're not going to sell many quilts. And again, just basic marketer would tell you, that's going to be challenging. Now, there is good news here, but I'm just saying, I think we just have to kind of curb our expectations because the population is shifting a bit underneath us. So let's take a look at, again, before you go, great, that's really exciting. there is some good news. When we look at, you know, the millennial mindset and what does that mean for us as a classical Christian school, there are positives here. And I would say that some of these are virtues that have vices behind them, but I think it can be good. So individualism and attention is a high value for the millennials. They grew up with, you know, everything was custom ordered and private encouragement of tutors and so on and so forth. And I think individualism fits well in loco parentis. I mean, as people are out shopping classical Christian schools, I know at Ambrose they've often said, this is so different. We were at Challenger or whatever thing, went to look at that, and it was sort of one of those, hey, thanks for the tuition. We'll call you if there's a problem. See you in May. We really don't need you in the building. I mean, there's a very much an industrialized view of education, even outside of the public schools. I think parents are saying, I don't really know what classical Christian is, but I really like the idea that you know my kid's name, and there's a sense in which I get to be a part of that process. Millennials really gravitate towards that. So I think you can, again, as you think about how you tell the story, that we do know your child's name, and we do want you to, let me explain what in loco parentis means. Like, we need you to be a part of this. I think they will deeply appreciate that. They want to be good parents, and I will say that is very much a high mark on millennials. Like, yes, I don't want to do whatever didn't happen right. I'm going to do this really, really well. So that's a positive. This is something I hadn't thought about until recently, and I was thinking, all right, classical Christian education, kind of old world. And I thought, wait a minute, that's the in millennial thing. Nobody buys, you know, beer in, you know, 12-pack whatevers anymore. You go down to this guy handcrafted it, you know, in his basement. He grew the hops in his kitchen sink. I mean, it's like, really? handcraft furniture's that way. You ask a millennial, they don't want big box, they want boutique. And I think the more you become the boutique solution, the more they're going to say, yes, that's not only do you know my name, but you're doing it the old way. I mean, you're even older than Cracker Barrel. Like, you've got the really old good stuff. And I mean, they want that. And I think that, you know, that's really who we are. And I think even I've had a shift, and I'll talk a little bit more about marketing, but we often market, at least in Atlanta, it's like, let's go find the oldest looking English, you know, image of the crest. And, you know, we want to have the old ways from Oxford and Cambridge. And they look at that and they're not impressed by that. They're impressed by, you really do it. You teach cursive. Like, that's amazing. You know, you guys do it like my grandparents wrote that way, you know, that kind of thing. The other one would be personal experience. Again, this is no surprise. Millennials want a personal experience. And again, in the age of sort of technological Dewey-ian based kind of education, you actually do that. You do Egyptian Day and Third Day. You do Pioneer Day. We dress up. We get to show. You know, we do hallway sayings. The seniors get to go on a trip to Europe, and we get to experience this. That whole, and you know, I get to drive on a field trip. Maybe that's not good, but you know, we want to be a part of this thing. And so again, maybe the Gen X parents weren't quite that intentional. They were too busy pursuing the career. And as I'll talk about in a minute, millennials' careers, just, you know, if it happens, it happens. And they may end up in parents' basement, but they will figure out their own way. But experience is a huge part of the millennial experience. Simplicity, I've kind of alluded to some of this before. And I think at Heritage in Atlanta, we were very prescriptive. You couldn't just tack things up on the wall. There was sort of a bulletin board, and there was a black border, and you had to kind of follow. We don't want primary colors. It's classical. We want it to be beautiful and exude truth, goodness, and beauty. Absolutely. And you know what? Millennials look at that and they think, I like that. I like the sense in which it's not cluttered. You know, I don't really want my kid to have an iPad. I want them to really sit there and be able to focus and be in a controlled environment. And what they see is orderliness fits that idea of simplicity and kind of a reductionistic idea. Again, I'm not saying they understand it. I'm just saying, is there curb appeal when they look at the school? They think, that's actually attractive. I want more of that. Another one would be passion and zeal. And I know classical folks hear passion and they kind of bristle because it's sort of like, wait, that's not enlightened and academic, and I don't know what passion scares me a little bit. But let's face it, that's where passion, not reckless passion, but passion and zeal are very much a part of the millennial experience. And so the good news is that you get an infusion of millennials, which is pretty much who's showing up today with their kindergarten through, you know, lower grammar. They are really going to be excited. And so long as they're still in that happy honeymoon phase, and hopefully a long time, they will be your biggest fans. They're going to be posting constantly on social media. Look at my kid dressed up in Egyptian Day, and look at this that they're doing, and I'm part of this. And they will exceed all of your marketing stuff you did internally, because they're out there running circles in the parking lot, sending pictures and firing everybody up. And it's a really good thing. I mean, and it can obviously, there's a dark side to this, but in general, they are actually going to be, they're going to tell the story long before you got the newsletter out on Friday to tell what happened at Egyptian Day. I mean, it's like real-time video feed from your office. Like, that is amazing. I mean, it's really pretty amazing. And so that zeal is refreshing. And I love being, well, we do a new parents orientation. It's always exciting to go around the room. And, you know, they'll get weepy. Like, I've been trying to get in here, and this has been the most amazing thing. And my whole world is going to be better now. Again, we have to manage that because they will fire the real video feed out about the other stuff too. So we'll get to that. Passion zeal. Flexibility. 45% of millennials choose flexibility over pay. Again, when you have zero carbon footprint in your 500 square foot apartment thing, you don't really need pay, I guess they feel, until they come to the school and there's tuition, they got to figure that out. But I say all that to say flexibility is good, especially if you're in a younger school. Most of our ACCS schools are 150 and under in size, and, you know, it's a few faithful folks doing 20 jobs, and you got to be flexible. And that's, again, I think in the generations of old, maybe flexibility was a little more frustrating. It's like, no, we have to have a policy and a procedure for everything. And they're like, hey, I can roll with that. We just, you know, combine second and third grade. Okay, great. More kids run and play with it. I mean, they're going to be a little bit more flexible, and I think we can appreciate that. But let's talk about some of the dark side, some of the challenges we face when millennials come into our school. Probably the biggest, undoubtedly, is the authority issue. This is the outbirth of the anti-establishment 60s hippies passed on through the Gen Xers, is really, has come home to roost. And so you see a lot of millennial parents showing up with this is my buddy, my friend, my son, we're tight, they have authority. Authority is good so far as it doesn't get beyond them. It was interesting. Pew and their study said only, this is amazing, 2012, only 19% of millennials say others can be trusted. Again, if you're a millennial, you're like, I don't think that. Okay, I know. But in general, there's a suspicion of authority. So guess what? When they show up and you do new parent orientation, and here's the parent-student handbook, and let me tell you about uniforms and why we don't do it this way, we only do it that way, there's going to be an immediate, just visceral sense of, okay, but here's what we're going to do with our family because I am an involved parent. I know best. And you know that uniform thing? I got to tell you, those pants, you got them from L.L. Bean, they just don't fit right. And these other pants that I found, they're going to be a better fit. So just know we're going to kind of hear you, but we're going to do this thing over here. So you have to figure back to, and we'll talk about how you deal with that. Of course, the great concern in all of this is we're there to point them to God as the ultimate authority. So if 19% don't trust human authority, where is God in all of this? And what does that mean to say you serve a Lord that's on the throne who loves you deeply, but there is right and wrong, and there's truth and false, and we've got to. That doesn't sit easy with them. It's good so long as it works with what fits with them, and it's really hard. So guess what? When it's time for seeking advice, guess where they go? If they don't go to grandparents, they go to Google. Yeah, it's not great. It's Google. It's a Google day, and they'll check out the answers to life. Grandparents are not the go-to maybe so much anymore. It's like I don't know how to. I need cloth diapers, or I got to figure out how to do, I'm going to go check what Google says. And I think, again, there's a sense in which I can't really trust anybody over X age, pick the number, just like the bias of the older generations is I don't really, I don't hire anybody if they're under 40, we just don't trust those people. So we'll talk about bias, but I think there's a challenge that we're facing right now, and it's an authority crisis, and it really is everything we stand for is about surrender to authority under Christ. And that's something innately they're going to bump into it a bit. This is really interesting, fear of elitism. If you were in my talk last year at Ambrose, we did a really interesting thing. We did these father roundtables and mother's coffees. So we went out and we challenged. We had 76% of 300 families that came to a father roundtable. This is like groups of 4 to 5 fathers for a 45-minute session. And we listened to them and we shared the vision of the school. And one thing that just completely caught me off guard was the number of these younger dads that came in and said, I love the school. Actually, I'd say, I feel like we're a little elitist. And as if there's like the absolute cardinal sin, we cannot be elitist. I said, what do you mean? It's like, well, we just look a little pretentious. We got this nice building and we kind of have the uniform thing going. I'm just not comfortable about it. I don't want to be elitist. And I appreciate it. And maybe I think the West is more exaggerated. In Atlanta, we pride ourselves on which bumper stickers on our car and all of that. But there is a sense in which millennials are leery again of sort of the big brother on high, the big authority structure, the flaunting money. They want to be simple. They want to be kind of, we don't want to be elitist. I was talking to Nate Wilson about this. Nate said, it's really funny though, because it's complete hypocrites. They're completely elitist. They just don't see it that way. They will go and buy the recycled furniture made out of the shopping cart for, $2,000 for their little apartment, or they'll order the organic tomato made with, exotic manure for a certain amount of money and never think twice about it. But don't look elitist at the school. So again, I think as you think about your branding, and again, depending on where you are, maybe that's actually rubbing. And I had no idea I thought it was a good thing to look like we were, somewhere in Oxford or Cambridge. It might scare them off. Feelings over facts. Again, you kind of knew this one was coming. Look at the current political debates today. There's not a lot of facts going on. It's just very feeling-based. And again, I don't have an easy answer. We'll talk in a minute about some best practices. But I do think that's just being aware that sometimes when the arguments are coming in, they're maybe not steeped in thoughtfulness. And again, how do we help educate parents is going to be a big part of that. Full-service expectations, entitlement. I remember at Heritage in Atlanta, our first generation, first families come in. We were giving out phonics cards that we thought, hey, review these at home and, read your kids' basic stuff. And today it's like, no, I bought an education for my child. I'm not planning on reading to them. Why would I read to them? And again, I'm being a little facetious, but I'm not far off. There's a sense in which I'm hiring you to do that. And so how in the world do we do in Loco Parentis when there's an attitude of I don't really think I have a role in this? There are some upsides that we'll talk about in just a second with that. Say versus hear is an interesting one. This is really the kind of the attitude that for millennials, where we say something and then they selectively hear it. So some of the business books we're talking about, you'll see a young millennial show up in a law firm. It's their first year end, and they're thinking, I'm sure I'll be partner very soon. And so they sit down, with a senior partner and just say, and the senior partner says, well, yeah, someday you could be a senior partner, and you're going to need to do this and do that and, grit your teeth and work hard. And they're great, and they walk out. And then 2 years later, they got a chip on their shoulder because he told me that I could be a senior partner, forgetting all of the criteria to become the senior partner. So there's a little bit of that. Your kid will be successful at our school. Great. I know they will. You're going to do it all right. No, you're going to be a part. So again, just be aware that there's a chance, because they've grown up in a culture where the mindset has been, you get what you want. Like, we're here to serve. And so how do we help mitigate that? We'll talk about that. Virtue of fit. And this is, I feel like we're hearing this more and more, which is, I'm sorry, we're going to be leaving. It's just not a fit. Whatever that means, it's just a fit. It's a fit thing. Pants don't fit, school doesn't fit. I mean, I don't know what that really means. It's a very cursory appreciation of the school. And again, more on us, I think, to connect and explain that, look, fit sometimes isn't going to feel like a fit. It's going to mean that you've got to see a greater end in mind. One of our dads that just graduated, his youngest, family of five who've come through, we've been around 23 years, they were 22 years, basically. And I've asked him many times, I said, you guys went through a lot. You were kind of the class, you had many new teachers, you had a lot of bumps and bruises early in on the school. What made you stick? He said, I remember early on the vision that my daughter or son at some point would graduate, not just graduate, but 10 years, 20 years, 30 years out, there's a sense of character, of integrity and depth and love for Christ that so supersedes anything. So I'm willing to kind of endure the bumps right now. And millennials look at that and go, I can't think that far. I'm just saying right now, Johnny's not having a good fit day, and I'm not sure this is going to be a good school for us. So my Fitbit tells me he's there. suspicion of the past. Again, you knew this was coming. And you have an iPhone 4? Like, what in the world? Anything that suggests, and you're a school that does what? The classics? Why? Why would you even think about that? Why would you have anything to do with, biased history of the past and so on and so forth? And these are good Christian people that, again, look at the most of the churches today. If it didn't happen after 1997, it probably didn't really exist. And so I think there's we're up against that. Before we even have the first word out of our mouth when they walk in to see the school, all this is churning in their head. So let's move on to kind of just some, what are we going to be doing about that? And I want to be, this is hours of thoughts on this that I'd love to have conversation with. But some good things are in our court that I really do think are encouraging. David Goodwin's famous for the 16,000 hours thought. It's 16,000 hours of time that we get to spend from kindergarten through 12th grade with these kids. So even though you've got millennial kids in your, maybe you're a boomer and extra in your classroom, you've got more time for influence than the church. And Nate Wilson recently made he's talking about just the number of, and Ben Merkel talking to him too, and I say it's just amazing the influence opportunities we have. I mean, the average third grade teacher gets more hours of exposure with a child than the typical church pastor does preaching faithfully 52 weeks of the year for 20 minutes. Nothing against the church, and that's great, but it's just math on that alone. That's a lot of influence. Mary Ellen St. Pierre, maybe you're just at her talk on Charlotte Mason, but Charlotte Mason is a huge advocate of habit training. And just the repeated effort day in and day out of teaching them to attend, to focus. Habit training is a huge part of what we get to do. And so again, no matter what their home environment or the media world outside our doors, when they're in our little world, we have time and attention to shape and to mold and to create. We at Ambrose talk about the idea of creating, helping them to love the good, shaping their affections, their passions. We get to control that, even though the world is leeching in and we do insist on phones being off. So another one is parent education. I love the fact that the millennials are open to parent engagement or to guidance, positive guidance. Now, we couch that in terms of, again, the top-down authority of we do it because it's in the handbook and you have to do it. That just doesn't fly. I'll give you a success story. Carl Warmoth, who is our fantastic grammar school principal, had just this year ago had a young, I think it was a first-grade kid who just like every other day was in his office. And Carl's like, what in the world? Like, and I called the mom, called the dad, and they were like, okay, we're sorry, we'll work on that. Okay, we're sorry, we're working. And then finally, after a while, he said, you guys need to come in and let's talk this thing through. And about halfway through the conversation, with an amazing amount of humility, and this father, very successful, played, top athletic, success in all the ways the world would think, but just looked at Carl and kind of teary-eyed said, I don't know what I'm doing. And Carl said, that's okay. Let me give you some pointers. And so they broke this relationship where for a while, it was about every week, the dad was coming to Carl's office and just saying, hey, I'm trying this discipline thing at home. I was trying to be the friend. That thing didn't work. So what do I need to do? He said, you need to be the authority. Let me show you how. So I'm finding more and more. Again, I think we've in a perfect world, there's the church and there's the family and there's the school and this beautiful triad and everybody's doing their job. We're having to do a little bit of coming alongside the church and the family. And again, it's a gentle balance. But I think that's a beautiful thing in the millennial world is, yeah, we would love to know more. And I think the more you offer parent education, I think they will genuinely want to come with a receptive idea. And also the vision that you're casting, be explicit, back this idea of saying versus hearing. What are you really expecting? I don't think just because we think we know what it means to read at home did not mean Captain Underpants for 5 minutes before they went to bed. Like, we got to be very specific about what we're expecting. And here's the reading list. And oh, here's training. And the more you can do that, I think the more they will come alongside you with that. The other thing just to mention on millennial kids and the boomer extra classroom is kind of the teacher's balance of authority and discipleship. And again, this really goes back to what Doug Wilson so wonderfully said yesterday about the role of the teacher today. I mean, we are really Christ embodied in this classroom. And I think that depending on your teaching style, you've really got to figure out where that balance is. And we've seen it falling off the cart, both sides at our school trying to figure out, we know we're not the youth group leader. We know we're not usurping the parents' authority as a discipler in the life of this child and in their walk with Christ. At the same time, we can't just be even in the best of classical Christian education, we can't just be the classroom facilitator. There's got to be this coming together of working to challenge and to encourage. It's high touch and grace-filled in discipleship. And I think challenging millennial teachers, and again, this is a whole separate talk, but again, we have millennial teachers that have been to great classical Christian schools that are bringing this wiring at a subconscious level into the classrooms. And we've had to work that through with the older generations, feeling this way about the younger generations, and it's been divisive within the teacher ranks. We've worked through that, and it's been a healthy thing. But I think we just had to step back and talk about it at that level. Just some pauses on kind of donors and volunteers and leaders. With donors, I've learned part of my job with advancement is just trying to figure out how in the world do you do advancement with a millennial generation. The good news is that they're one of the biggest saving generations out there. They really are. They're not into the 80s materialism. They will put the money away. They're trying. They're saving more than other generations have. But what they're not going to be responsive to is the fancy brochure you stick in the mail and go, hey, give to our campaign. One of the things that they want to know is the why. And if you don't hear anything else today, it would be the importance of why over what. And if you ask a classical Christian person or you ask it just an average parent, tell me about your school. Well, we're involved in the trivium, and the trivium is this wonderful three-step process for education. Like, that's great. They don't care. They don't care. You don't go buy a car and want to know, the fuel consumption rates of the injectors. They don't care. They want to know. And I'm not being dismissive that they're not open to hearing about it. But I think why is your school going to be significant in the life of their child? Why is it that if I write this check, it's actually going to make some difference? So we are in the midst of a capital campaign, about a $3 million campaign at Ambrose. And I just said, I am throwing out basically everything everybody's ever told me about capital campaigns. Not all of it. But let me just figure out, how do I build a campaign around the why? And so I literally, we're in the process of finishing out a 10-year master plan on the building, and we're trying to add an auxiliary gym, and we're adding a cafeteria, theater space, and classrooms. And I'm thinking, I've got kindergartners that don't even know we have a gym. So if I send a brochure out and talk about why we need an auxiliary gym, I'm not sure many of them are going to even know or care, or they're going to think you guys are just doing that country club thing and building something and we don't really need it. Why do I care? So we, in the vein of what we did 2 years ago, the roundtables, this year we did in-home dinners. And it started out kind of traditional silent campaign. Let's bring together kind of key donor, key net worth families that we think want to hear the story early, and we're going to share the vision, kind of get them to commit early, and then we'll take it to the whole community. But it was interesting, about three dinners in, Kirk and I ended up doing about 35 dinners. I don't know why, I don't weigh a lot more, between January and May, in homes with about 4 to 6 couples. And after about the third one, we had families saying, that was more fun than we've had in the longest time. Could we just do like dinner club? Would that be possible? Like, we kids were in, had childcare set up, and we had a caterer came in and did it on a low budget. It wasn't fancy stuff, but it was just moment to be with these young families and share the vision of the school and answer their questions. And they left thinking, I'm really excited about where our school's going, and I know the why. They know the why. So the whole campaign has been built around the 9 pain points, from parking. And I got very specific. Let me use the example of little Susie, who's trying to navigate our crazy parking lot. Wouldn't it be great if we had more parking spaces? Let me talk to you about athletics. You got kids that like athletics. We have one gym. There's only so much time in the day. They're having to come early and stay late. It's impacting homework. We only have so many restrooms. So all of a sudden, something like restrooms got really exciting, because they realized that restrooms, inadequate restrooms, mean not kids leaving classroom, teaching time is being lost, so they can go find the restroom. Now they're leaving going, we need restrooms. I'm like, great, I feel the same way. So we have tried to work this from the why, not the what. And I think that is imperative in anything you do with whether it's explaining your vision for classical Christian education or fundraising, for sure. I think that has been a good example of something that's worked well for us. Volunteers, again, this is a generation that has been raised on volunteerism. It's, you know, they're out serving in the community, and it's a wonderful part of the millennial kind of DNA. And again, if anything, what we heard through our roundtables, many parents were saying, we want to volunteer, we don't know how. And I'm like, well, you just show up and ask. I'm like, that's probably not good enough. We could do a better job of onboarding them. You know, they want the app that you click on, like, here are the 5 things today that you could show up and do. And, you know, we're not far from that. These apps are being developed, and we're trying, again, back to the Chick-fil-A example, how do we kind of bring real-time solutions, if not technically, at least making it available, that we do want you to volunteer, and here are specific ways you can come and be a part of the school. Come read in this class, or come help at recess, or drive carpool, or whatever it may be. But again, I would say you have to be very explicit, and you need to give them a clear invitation. Don't assume they're just, some of them will not push their way in. They're going to wait until you've kind of painted a clear picture of how to come and volunteer. And I think with leaders in general, it's just stories-driven opportunities. And here's an example. Giving them examples of why coming and being involved in leadership is really important. One of the things we're trying to share, I'm letting you into kind of the Ambrose, here's what's cooking in the back. We're trying to figure this thing out. Kirk, who's our Vanderlis, our head of school, and I were talking at length about, given that they want the why, and given that they're struggling with authority, and we heard in a lot of our in-home dinners, just politely worded, but it's, you know, you guys are off over there making all these decisions, and we don't get to be a part of it. I'm like, we send you more stuff all the time. We're constantly telling you what's going on, but their perception, again, is that we're not a part of it. You didn't ask. My mom always asked, like, what I wanted. Nobody's asking. I'm like, I'm sorry. And so we're, okay, we got, how do we, at least from a perception standpoint, how can we do a better job of decentralizing? It's not just the administration that has the corner on everything in the school, and it's not just come volunteer on our terms. So we had a kind of a mom that really inspired us, a third grade mom that just on her own millennial mom mindset said, hey, I'm a third grade mom, and there are lots of other third graders around. Let's get together. So before school even started, she emails out through her social media thing, and hey, I'm having a pool party. Bring your other moms come, and we're going to get the kids together, and hey, that was fun. Let's do it again next week. And so she just kind of started building this almost like a viral connection between third grade. Administration had nothing to do with it. And it was immediately received well and trusted because it was another third grade mom kind of at that level. So I thought, well, this is remarkable. I mean, we administration could have had a pool party, you know, and set up like, you know, all of our, and I don't think it would have been nearly as well received because it's come from the mom. So what can we do to capitalize that? So I stopped the mom down and said, what'd you do? How'd you do it? And we've come up with this idea of kind of a grade level coordinator. Now, we've had forever homeroom parents, and their job is to make sure the teacher's birthday is never missed. And their job is to make sure that we collect $5 for the gift, you know, at Christmas. Like, okay, that's all good. And we're going to keep the homeroom parent, and the homeroom parent's job is, in fact, to support the teacher and do the birthday thing. And absolutely want to support the parent. But who is waking up in the morning and thinking about building connection between the grade level? Because, again, in the millennial mindset, they're living with this peer base. These are all the third grade folks. So we have identified at the end of the school year, I surveyed out to all of our, I said, I need to know teachers who are kind of your superstar socialites in each grade level. Give me their names. And we're in the process of doing that this summer, going back to them and saying, okay, you're going to be our new third grade, even if they're two third grades, you're going to be our third grade level coordinator, or fourth grade coordinator. And your job is the following. First of all, it's to make sure, you know, no parent left behind. We're going to make sure that we're going to connect every parent at the grade level. That's going to work. We're going to make sure that there's social events happening for moms and for dads. And, oh, by the way, the advancement guy in me, guess what? Your job's also going to be, we're going to have a little fun with the annual fund this year. The annual fund, by the way, is no longer give to the school because we're doing great things. It's here's the wish list. Like, we need this microscope in this science class, and we need this particular thing in our fourth grade. And I'm finding identifying the why and the specifics are critical. And then secondly, leveraging the grade level coordinator to say, hey, fourth grade parents, let's get involved here. We got to get this microscope thing solved. I'm willing to go in. You guys get in. Let's make this thing happen. It's really kind of the GoFundMe kind of strategy at a grade level. And you see them sort of working collaboratively. And there's a little competition. So, you know, I'm planning on running kind of percentages. Hey, fourth grade's up to 15% participation. The annual fund, you guys are at 25% in the fifth grade. And without making it top heavy, it's coming from among the peers. So I think that grade level, check back with me. I'll let you know in a year how it works. I think it's going to be successful. Obviously, it's dependent on the degree of commitment of that individual who's running that piece. But we're going to pour into those coordinators and have them work together. So let me give you some more best practices, and then I'll love to do a little Q&A if we have time for it. The first thing is just suspend your bias. And that's what I mean by that is, I know I've been guilty of this, and I'm a Gen Xer, but I've just thought some comment about broadly generalizing a population of our teacher base or our parent base and saying those Xers or those millennials, you know, we're not going to whatever. Yeah, I'm trying to be kind of how I say it. I think I get biased, and it's not Christ-like to begin with, just to lump a group of people into one big bucket and make a judgment on them. The other thing is recognizing the things that, yeah, you know what, I'm an Xer and I have certain expectations, and I can be kind of type A, and part of that's my personality, but it's also part of my generation. They're more flexible. They're going to come to me, and we had a policy in Atlanta that I think is a good policy. It's like, look, it's on our handbook. We don't go take a vacation in a random moment in the year. We have nice fall breaks and spring breaks. Don't come tell me that Disney's got a sale, and you guys are going to be on the cruise, and they're going to be going away in the middle of September, right in the middle of an academic week. And a millennial would think nothing of that. Well, my goodness, it's our family together. Well, you know, I'm sure it's not that. You can make it up. Can't you put it in a notebook? We'll take it with us on the cruise. And before, we were like, no, we're not going to make it up. And I'm so sorry. And, you know, don't come ask a teacher and you're probably going to fail. I mean, it felt about like that. And there's a part of me as an administrator going, well, yeah, you're right. What? You can't leave. You can't do that to our teachers. That's stressful. There's the other part of me, I think, suspending the bias, going, all right, look, they do need some flexibility. Now, I'm not saying you just throw out the policy, but I don't think you quote chapter and verse on your vacation policy and get obstinate and kind of dismiss the crazy millennials. I think we've got to figure out a way to work together on this. And again, there's 1,000 examples, and it's messy, and you got to work it through. But I think that, let's face it, what parents, even Gen Xers, were reading the parent student handbook so that we can remember that, you know, 3 months later? So we could do a better job communicating that. And that really gets into identifying essential and non-essential policies. There are some things that we really can't compromise, and we are a classical Christian school. And I know they want to teach Spanish. I know you want Spanish. We're really going to do Latin, and we're going to explain why that's important, and we're going to get your buy-in, and you'd be passionate about that and be an advocate for us. Maybe there's some other things that we just really need to go away. Maybe it's part of a style of the uniform, and we just look like it's 1983, and it's okay that we're going to change our uniform a little bit to kind of maybe accommodate some styles or some desires. There's, again, 1,000 examples. I think we have to be willing, and it's very hard for us as classical Christian educators, because I think part of our natural bent is to be the guy that's nailing the stake in the ground going, we will not move. We are going to hold true. We're 1,500 years old, you crazy Dewey people doing all your thing. We're going to hold tight. And we have to have that, but I think we also have to be willing to acknowledge there's some non-essentials that we are maybe needing to give up. Relationship and discipleship, again, talked about this earlier. It's everything's through the sense of from dealing with conflict management with millennial parents. How do we really let them know, first and foremost, we love you, we know who you are, we're walking with you. It's just the basic stuff. It's just healthy. Teachers ought to be communicating consistently with parents. These are the feedback generation. And I hope, I know we've tried schools I've been a part of, certainly in the grammar school, there ought to be a Friday flyer or whatever. And hey, here's what's happened this week at school. And, you know, ideally with some regularity, and I've even said to teachers, you really need to write this stuff. You ideally need to track this. So, like, when was the last time I personally communicated with Susie's parents? Even if it's a two-sentence note, hey, Susie had a great day today, it was really going well, that's that individualism, that's the high touch. Those are urgently needed in millennial relationships. And it's such a pain in some ways in the mind of the teacher because they're busy. But that two-sentence email to Susie's parents made a deposit that 2 months later will bear hours of savings when Susie's mom comes stomping in with a big upset because she's heard nothing from the teacher until a moment of friction. So, again, investing in the relationship is critical, and I hope this is kind of commonsensical, but it's so important with millennials. Maximizing input opportunities is really critical. And again, I kind of alluded to that with the classroom coordinator role. We are in the process right now at looking at estate planning, kind of new territory for us in our development world. And so I pulled together some millennial CPA and an attorney, and I just said, let's, you guys help me figure this out. And I had one mom that showed up, it was on the task force, this seems very important. So they were being able to provide input and bringing professional wisdom. This mom was a CPA and had sort of stepped out to be a young mom out of the professional world. And she went and dusted off her little suit and showed up for the meeting. And she was so excited, like she gets to be a part of this. And her investment is deeply appreciated and she feels valued and connected. And so maybe building more just voices and task force for input and opportunity. I would tell you, expect venting, and this is going to be really hard. They will vent, and it may not even be personal. This is the protest. I read the Oberlin College. They got to say it. They got to come tell you about it, and it's a little bit of just let them ooze it. It's like lancing the wound. Let them get it out. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And don't go, I must be a horrible teacher. The school is falling to pieces. Some of it's just the currency they trade, and I don't know, maybe it's like stereotyping the Italians. If you're Italian, I'm sorry, but it's sort of like Italians are just loud and they're expressive. Well, okay, if you're having a conversation with an Italian and they're doing that, they're not offending you to offend you. That's just kind of their natural temperament. And I think that we have to recognize millennials are the ones that are going to immediately, again, millennials shop how? They go to Amazon, we do it too. We go, we look at reviews. Like, I'm not buying anything until I've made sure what everybody's opinion is of it. We want to know the opinions. Good and bad. Expect venting. Students as customers, it's not just the parents. Again, I know that rubs against every probably fiber in our being. Like, no, they're not the customer. They're little kids and they need to obey. They do. But at the same time, I had an hour and a half long conversation last week in the Denver airport. We were flying back from 2 weeks in Africa. And I'll make another point on that in a second. But I had a young man who is sort of struggling with whether or not he wants to stay. I'm like, it shouldn't be the parent's decision. Maybe, right? He's struggling with whether or not he wants to stay and come back. And I realized in talking to him, we have done a very poor job of explaining to the level that they can embrace and understand why a classical Christian school is inherently more valuable than the generic Christian school down the street. They can't really explain that. And they can mumble around Latin and they'll tell you about Spanish or whatever, but they don't really. So how do we, as intentionally as we go after the parents, go after the students? Maybe we're thinking this year we've got an upper school retreat, take them off campus. Part of that is let's just spend some time casting the vision. If you were to enroll in the Naval Academy, I think the cadets probably spend the first weeks or who knows how long saying, hey, you're stepping into a tradition. You're going to become somebody great because of this environment that you're in. So kind of owning that experience. The why over the what we've talked about was serve in the community. One of the big example of another change we made that really resonated well with our millennials. For years, we had the beloved chili fest in the fall. And this was like, you know, all the dads brewing up their favorite chili recipes. And it was really great when the school was smaller and it was a great fellowship time. We'd send picnic baskets and do the deal. And then we realized we didn't have enough plugs for all the crock pots and we started struggling with how we're going to even do it. But the bigger vision came thanks to our friends at Logos. They've done this thing called Feed the Need. And they partnered with some local farmers. We thought, this is a genius idea. So we said, no more chili fest, but we're going to in one day turn our gym into a food packing warehouse. And we're going to bring in thousands of pounds of dried beans, and we had the team that came from northern Idaho came down with all of the spices. And basically, we had a factory where in one day, all of our students got to come in. Parents were helping with this. And we bagged up enough soup to feed 60,000 people. And we had the governor's wife came. We had the mayor. We had, like, everybody came out. It was on the three. I was like, three news stations were there. We're just feeding the needs. But it was such, it resonated so long. Every millennial parent was like, yes, that's what I want my children to learn about. It's not about them. It's about serving. But it solved all the other things we always wanted. We still had some chili to eat. We had fellowship. But we just exponentially grew from a marketing standpoint, from a buy-in on the millennial family. So I would say serving is a huge part of that. Story-driven. Every other week we do kind of a chapel and exordium. I try really hard at the end of it to come in and say, let me tell you, grammar school parents, some glimpses of things that are happening in the upper school. You know, we just had a perfect score on the ACT, which is a pretty fun story to tell. Or we had this amazing kind act. We had a child in the grammar school. And again, I don't have time to share all this. We ended up making a short form video about it because it was so powerful. Just a little boy, little girl's necklace broke, and the little boy said, I think I can fix that. And so he came to the office and asked the principal and said, do you have a pair of pliers? I got to try to fix this. And so it was this beautiful story of just, you know, a young man trying to serve in the school. It, in many ways, would have just been dismissed. That's cute. Thank you. The teacher saw it, told the, you know, principal got involved. We created a whole video about it. We told the story and the upper school as well as the grammar school. And people are like, no, that's why I'm at your school. I love the story. Stories carry. And again, social media, being mobile savviness is such an important part of where our students are today. I see Ralph Cochran here, you know, inbound marketing. But we've got to rethink, and it's a whole other talk, just on how do we communicate what we're doing. If you've got a static web page, yay, the millennials will go there, but you better be dynamic in it. And I think even if you had to hire somebody as a part-time position, that, you know, they're just thinking about short-form videos and telling stories in social media, that's going to be a critical part of it. 6% find traditional advertising compelling today of the millennials. So let me kind of hold there, and there's a lot we can talk about. We've got about, I don't know, 2 minutes, 3 minutes left. This is a kind of an interesting app. If you go on your smartphone and you type my name, Davies, D-A-V-I-S, to 33733, it will fire you back a set of links. You'll get my phone number, my email. If you want to email me, you'll get a link to this Prezi, so you can actually see it. I know it's been hard to see it. And then also, if you're interested, a few years ago, I did a Q talk on what is classical Christian education in 18 minutes, and that's a helpful tool. So that way you can keep up with all that I've set up here. So, yes. Can you read that? So, okay. Yeah, that's hard. So you're going to text to the number 33733, my name, D-A-V-I-S, and hit send, just like you're texting to a person. So. Any, however you text anybody else in the world, any text program you've got on your phone. Oh, to use this. I can tell you about it. It's a friend of mine that runs a company that's doing that. So it's a different, it's called Smart Story. Yes. Hey, Ralph. Yes. Absolutely. No, that's a good point. I think there's definitely it appeals to their sense of simplicity and frugality, and some of the life journey I think would be there. And you do see that. I mean, there are some beautiful generational connections we certainly see through our grandparents, where the younger generation wants to bring the grandparents in and have that voice. So I don't know if you and specifically I'm yeah. Yeah, no, and I alluded to that earlier. 100%, when I'm talking to a builder, older generation, they immediately gravitate to seeing the value. We've got donors at Ambrose that have never darkened the door of the school that are of a builder generation that have said, I don't know what you're doing, but the kids that are in the neighborhood, yours at that school are totally different, and I want more of that, whatever it is. And they resonate with all of the things that classical education stands for. So, yes, ma'am. I didn't talk about that. That's all for another. Yeah. I think this is just one book. I would say for you to read Managing the Millennials, and it's Espinoza, Espinoza, is one of, there are many people talking about this. I think the best thing to do, actually, would simply be to come together with your staff, and I think it'd be a great exercise just to talk through, here are all the generations, are these even accurate representations, have we left things out, and then just say, where do you place yourself, where do you resonate most, and then what are the points of friction that we're going to have potentially as a staff, and certainly as we engage parents. And again, I recognize it's a big generalization, but I think it certainly would foster a healthy conversation. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes. It is a huge selling point. Absolutely. Yeah, and I should have mentioned that. I appreciate it. So if you're not familiar with the house program, all of our 7th through 12th grade divided into 1 of 6 houses, it is an opportunity for mentorship. So it checks the relationship box, which is huge. Community service box gets checked. It checks every I think it's really I can't say enough. Yeah, and if you want to know more about it, Jordan Tucker at our school can send you information on how we set up the house program. But that's, yeah, good. We're officially at time, so I think there's food to be had. Thank you.